As the 150th anniversary of the American Civil War is upon us, and we reflect on the changes and growing pains of our country, it's not so much anymore about remembering the past as it is about researching a variety of historical resources to put things into our own current cultural perspective. And one issue, which is obviously tied to the Civil War, is that of slavery. While many of us realize that Minnesota was part of the North during the war, not too many of us know of all the effects that slavery had upon the upper Midwestern states, both before and after they achieved statehood. Today, if you were to ask your average St. Cloud resident the question of whether or not there were ever slaves in St. Cloud, you'd probably receive an answer of no, of course not. We were in the North. Historical fact, however, tells a very different story. Yes, there were slaves in St. Cloud, as well as the rest of the Northwestern territories at that time. And the manner in which this divisive issue was dealt with in the past can give us insight into the way we deal with race and other issues today. Talking with me this afternoon is Christopher Lehman, a St. Cloud State University professor and writer of a new book entitled Slavery in the Upper Mississippi Valley from 1787 until 1865, A History of Human Bondage in Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. Thank you for talking with me today, Christopher. And can you maybe start off with a little bit of your background as well as what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I'm Christopher Lehman, and I'm a professor here at St. Cloud State in the Ethnic Studies Department. And I had been researching African-American history on a local level for about 8 years. And what happened around the time that I got here, maybe within the first or second year, was that my wife was giving a talk, and it was here in town, about African-American issues. And during the question and answer session that happened afterward, there's a person in her mid-40s who had a comment instead of a question. And what she said was that St. Cloud had been just fine before you people came along. And with her being someone roughly in her 40s or 50s, from what my wife told me, since I wasn't there at that particular event, I decided, as someone who's trained in history, to look up that information for myself. When did African Americans get here? Based on her comment, it seemed as if she would have been old enough to remember the first African Americans arriving here. But in my research, I found that that was back in the 1850s. And it was people bringing African-American slaves to St. Cloud that led to the presence of African-Americans beginning here. And I'd never heard of slaves being in the Midwest before, so I thought that it would be an interesting topic for me to pursue. And I wrote a couple of articles for the county newsletter. But in the meantime, I was working on what at the time was my passion, which was writing about African-American film history. And I'd make books out of those topics that I was interested in. But over the years, different people would ask me where they could pick up the book about local slavery. But I would keep having to tell them I didn't write that book. I haven't written a book about it. But after being asked enough times, I just decided to do it. And it's my first book that's not about film at all, so that was a stretch in and of itself. And I usually write about the 20th century, so to go back to the 18th and end at the 19th was another stretch. But I think that I just had some kind of responsibility. I don't know how else to explain why I wrote the book, but I'm glad it's out, and hopefully it provides people with a lot of things about the Midwest that they might not have known that much about before.
Yeah, well, yeah, there's a curiosity of, you know, well, what happened? You know, and enough people ask, and then you kind of recognize that there's a vacuum. You know, it's like, well, people do want to know, you know, where did this all come from? Because, you know, we're all just born into this world, and it's been moving along before we got here.
Right.
And it's like, well, what's been going on? What's been happening? And there is so much just information in the book, and it's very well documented as well. You can find where, you know, these things have been printed. I mean, it's kind of amazing, actually, the amount of recorded history that you're actually able to find. Now, I'm thinking particularly, you know, kind of at the beginning of the book, we're talking about just the exploration of this area by the Europeans.
Right.
And it becomes rather obvious rather quickly that some of these European, you know, I guess you'd say explorers, or not quite settlers at this point, but
right.
the people tracking or, you know, going through the wilderness, they might not have fared so well if it wasn't for the assistance of, you know, the slaves that they brought with them.
Right. That's definitely the case with Lewis and Clark, among other people, that Clark's slave York was very valuable for the mission that they had, which was not only in the Midwest, but well into the western part of the United States. But they also set a precedent of having the federal government's approval to take slaves to areas of the country that officially were free land, based on the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, and later with the Missouri Compromise of 1820. The federal government will, in the future, have stipends for people to bring slaves to start businesses like the mines in northwestern Illinois. And throughout the Northwest Territory, there'll be forts that'll be built up for people to arm themselves against the indigenous that are already there. And some of the soldiers that the president will appoint to those forts will be Southerners. And to entice them to be willing to leave the South and come to the Midwest, different presidents will say that they can bring their slaves along. In addition to the soldiers, the territories are being run by governors who are appointed by presidents, because since they're not states, the citizens of the territory are somehow not allowed to vote for their governor. So the president will appoint governors who will be Southerners as well sometimes. And the president will tell that their appointees to the governorship that they can bring slaves to. And so there's all sorts of things that are being done openly that can be documented because they're part of presidential papers. And at the time that these things are taking place, there isn't a terrible outcry among abolitionists. Abolitionism is not as strong as it will be by the Civil War, and it's certainly not terribly strong in the Midwest, because most people don't consider it an issue. So things are being done that, on the one hand, could be construed as being secret or hidden, but on the other hand, because it is well documented and it's obvious enough to anyone who sees the soldiers at the forts or who sees the governor in the governor's mansion, you could call it an open secret almost.
Well, so within this open secret, were there actual incidences of, you know, the northern states or northern territories being involved with the slave trade?
As far as slave trade goes, there were instances of slaves being bought and sold, especially in Illinois, but not so much in the other states. Now, what would happen in other states in the Midwest is that Southerners who had already brought their slaves up to the North will take them back down to the South, and they will stay slaves, even though since they were in a free land, they were supposed to be declared free. Now, sometimes slaves in the North we brought to the South, and a few of them will even be sold, which definitely happened to slaves who were kept here in St. Cloud for a while. And that, more than anything, is the tragedy of slavery in the Midwest, that the same things that happened to slaves in the South happened to slaves in these parts too, but they're just not as well known because it didn't happen as often here, and there's just this general historical assumption that slavery didn't happen here, and that there are too many people who were against slavery for there to be any substantial proof that it existed. But it did, and the same issues of family separation and of being sold and whatever labor the slaves did here, that's pretty consistent regardless of region.
Yeah, one of the things that kind of caught me in the book was there was a story about, well, in Iowa, the Iowans, the way they looked at it, there was a misconception that the slaves had themselves to blame for remaining slaves mm-hmm. when, you know, they were up here.
Right.
Well, maybe they didn't know, or mm-hmm. maybe, you know, there's a very different dynamic going on that we just don't understand.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there was one story about a person coming to Minnesota and telling his slaves, you're in free land now, you can leave if you want to. But unless you have a master specifically tell a slave that, it's very difficult for a slave to have that knowledge of being in the North and therefore being free, unless they have a really good, what they call a grapevine network in the South. If they knew based on what other slaves had told them before they left that they would be free once they got somewhere, there really wouldn't be any way for them to know. What would typically happen, especially after the Dred Scott case, is that in hotels in the Midwest, especially in Minnesota, people would arrive with their slaves, and then it would be the local people who would try to convince the slaves to escape and pursue their freedom. And it would be up to law enforcement officials to try to put down the local agitators. That happened here in St. Cloud. In fact, where you see the marker for the Stearns House Hotel here on the Riverwalk, if you can imagine a hotel being there, that was one place where, I think in 1857, someone had come from out of town with a slave, and local people tried to get that person freed, but then the St. Cloud law enforcement at the time put that to an end, and that person remained a slave during the time that the master stayed here.
You're listening to 88.1 FM KVSC. In an interview with Chris Lehman, who's written a book, Slavery in the Upper Mississippi Valley from 1787 to 1865. And we're talking about what might be considered a delicate issue in today's world, but there was a reality within our country's history not too long ago where slavery was the norm, not only on a national scale, but on a very local scale. So, Professor Lehman, well, about during this time, what was going on with the Supreme Courts and with other laws and legalities concerning slavery?
Well, what's going on is that with the Dred Scott case, the Supreme Court says that the Missouri Compromise is essentially unconstitutional, and that wherever a person brings a slave, that person remains a slave because that person is property. So you have, on the one hand, the local authorities who are enforcing the Dred Scott decision, but on the other hand, you have the local abolitionists who say, no, really, the Northwest Ordinance and the Missouri Compromise should still be law. So those two forces are at play. And the local abolitionists will especially have an upper hand when a year later Minnesota becomes a state and it becomes a free state. Then they'll have even less patience for people bringing their slaves into the state.
Yeah, and it is definitely an economic thing as well. I think that that's how a lot of people looked at the situation. They didn't look at it as slavery. They looked at it as economics. They're trying to run a business.
Right.
You know, one of the stories you had in there about the riverboats coming up north and how they operated where, you know, they're bringing people up from the south, all sorts of people up from the south, and they tried to maintain this southern culture all the way up the river.
Right.
And that's kind of what they did. And there was this just assumption of this is the way things are and this is the way things ought to be.
Right.
And there's a comfort with that.
Yes. So. Yeah, and plenty of people tried to market with that comfort. It wasn't just Southerners. There would be people from the East Coast who would come to Minnesota and start hotels to try to cater to Southern vacationing clientele by telling them, you'll come up here during the summer months. It's not as hot as it is down south. And you can bring your slaves here, and it'll be in a part of Minnesota that'll be tolerant of that. We won't mind. We won't try to take your slaves from you. So there was a lot of money to be made off of Southern slaveholding tourism. It was in the Twin Cities area. It was here. It was in Stillwater in Washington County. That business survived really until the Civil War, when Southerners felt that they had to stay in the South and defend the South. But if it weren't for the war, tourists probably would have continued to come to Minnesota and bring their slaves with them.
Well, we talk about the Civil War because that's an obvious tie-in with slavery. However, there was another conflict going on at this time as well in Minnesota, the Sioux War. Are there any connections between the Sioux War and, you know, issues with slavery?
Well, there's not that much that the Sioux had directly in relation to slaves when it comes to involvement in the controversy of slavery in Minnesota. However, because the Sioux War was so damaging to Minnesota in general, there were places that had just begun, small towns that had been named after prominent Southerners. And after the Dakota War, those towns were either renamed or they were just completely obliterated. Whenever people decided to start over, they renamed those towns after people who were not so much Southern, but more the standard American patriots. But where you have the dynamics of the indigenous population and slaves is more in the exploring years with Lewis and Clark, but also with a guy by the name of James Beckwith, who was an African-American slave in Illinois, who later became very friendly with the indigenous there and actually became well known as someone who was familiar with indigenous culture in the Midwest. And after he was freed, he went on to explore all sorts of indigenous lands. He even wrote an autobiography, which is one of my sources in the book. It's with those explorers that you find more of the interaction between the slaves and the indigenous people. Not so much with the Dakota War, though.
So, yeah, the Civil War comes along, and it kind of changes, well, obviously, the dynamic of the country. One thing I noticed in the book as well was the northern states and the upper Mississippi, when they were reporting how many African-American soldiers that they had, it actually, they had more African-American soldiers than they had African-Americans.
Yes.
Yeah, that was kind of interesting as well. But that also kind of goes back to, they did record everything.
Yes.
We're in an information age now. We don't really, we think back then to how things are recorded and we're like, well, how do they keep track of anything? But right. They actually did keep track of things rather well.
Yes.
How did the Civil War and those actions of, you know, those African Americans, did that change people's perception of, I don't know, the slavery, the abolitionists, what's the war about? Is it about preserving the Union? Is it about slavery? Mm-hmm. How did that work out?
Well, I think more than anything, Lincoln's election in 1860 was the beginning of the end of Midwestern slavery, because up until that time, there had been people in the Whig Party and the Democratic Party, largely, who were the ones who were appointing Southerners to these offices. But when Lincoln comes along, as with any new administration, the old appointees lose their jobs, and then the president appoints new people. So with Lincoln being a Republican, he appoints people who really don't have anything to do with slavery and have no interest in bringing it to the Midwest or keeping it in the Midwest or looking the other way, like his predecessor Buchanan had done. So that's the beginning of the end. And then once African-Americans begin to leave the South and come to the North as soldiers, that does change people's perceptions of African-Americans. If they were used to seeing African-Americans only along the river, in river boats as people's property, then it's different to have a whole lot more of them among you, and now they're armed, and they're supposed to be defending the country with you. There are some people who are just not ready for that, but they were used to the idea that they should not be slaves. So from the Civil War onward, there's this period of adjustment. How do you deal with people who you've only heard about from a distance, and your exposure to them has been as these people who were slaves who were not supposed to be? I think they got along well enough to be able to have the Union victory, but those issues about where do African Americans belong in the Midwest, if not as slaves, in those counties that were bordering the Mississippi River, that question did not get answered for a long time. And so you have things like segregation taking place in the Midwest and people holding on to the black codes that forbade Illinois and Iowa from having African Americans in the first place. And African Americans who were employed generally had jobs of being barbers and operating shoeshine parlors. And that's about it.
So basically, the lawmakers, they are saying, well, yeah, we're not going to, you know, we don't get into this slavery, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're, you know, like beacons of progressive thought. They're actually, it's almost closer to these people are different. We don't even want them here.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, that's something, it's a difficult thing to think about or to talk about because we don't exist in that world anymore for the most part.
Right.
And I think that's something that on one hand, we don't look at people as property anymore.
Right.
But on the other hand, we sure look at people as different.
Yes.
And looking at somebody as different than, you know, you treat them differently. One example out of the book, well, there are two things. One, there's a certain irony, I guess, where you have these stories of humane treatment of either the slaves or the once they're freed, you know, just interacting in society. And those are kind of offered up as almost stories or reasons to perpetuate the slavery. You know, somebody's kind to their slaves, like, oh, see, this system is working just fine.
Right.
But then you've got other stories that are just, they're almost offhand. You know, there's one about a wagon got stuck in the mud and a woman jumped out of the wagon, went up to her waist, and then they basically said that because she was stuck in the mud, it prohibited her retrieval from the mud.
Right.
Does that mean that they left her? And, you know, in the book, you're like, well, it's unclear. But at the same time, it's like, well, they never said that they got her out. So, you know, that's kind of this, you know, that's how daily life was.
Right.
In a way. And it's just, it's 150 years ago, but that's not that long ago if you think about it in the grand, you know, history of, you know, humankind.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so, but, I don't know. What do you think that some of these stories and some of these ideas, how do you think that they affect us today?
Well, I think that they would show that attitudes in the Midwest are not that different from what was going on in the South. I think that areas that did not officially have legal slavery tend to look down on Southern states for having it as legal policy. But when you read some of the things that are in the book, and when you notice that there are all sorts of parallels, not only with the issue of how slaves were sold and so forth, but even the kinds of relationships that take place. I mean, there are quite a few instances where a family brings up a female slave, and within a year or two, there's a new person in the house who's listed as mulatto, the term back then. And there are perhaps no other adult men in the household except for the head of the household. How does that woman get the baby? Well, you can put two and two together and figure it out. That's the same kind of stuff that happened in the South. Perhaps in the South, a master would have had a lot more access to a lot more female slaves as opposed to just the one or two that he would bring up to the North. But those same dynamics of money and sex are still there. And I think if people come away reading the book thinking that Iowa and Wisconsin and Minnesota and Illinois are not terribly different from Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama in terms of attitudes towards slaves and treatment of slavery, then I think that would go a long way toward the North not looking down on the South so much.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a perspective I can see out there. Even though we're all part of one country, we all share different perspectives about, and it's kind of a difficult topic of slavery and just race in America as well. So the book is Slavery in the Upper Mississippi Valley, 1787 to 1865. So Professor Lehman, where can people find this book?
It's principally available online. Now, it can be through the publisher's website, which is mcfarlandpub.com. But it's also available through amazon.com, barnesandnoble.com, any book retailer that offers books online.
I'd say it's an important part of our history. There's more than just curiosity. This is where we come from. This felt similar to that book that came out a little while back, the Minnesota 13, about the moonshining, you know, and it's just like, well, that is part of our history. Well, this is part of our history too.
Right.
So important book.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me today, Chris.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Once again, we've been talking with ethics professor Christopher Lehman from St. Cloud State University about his new book, Slavery in the Upper Mississippi Valley, 1787 to 1865, which can be found online at any of the major online booksellers. And also, more information on the book can be found on our website at kvsc.org under the podcasts and features link. And this has been Jeff Carmack reporting for KVSC Radio on a topic which reaches deep back into our cultural heritage. Funding for this report has been made possible through the Minnesota Historical and Cultural Legacy Grant. It has been produced by KVSC, a proud member of AMPERS, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities.